Library cataloging, as I said, is the activity of making systems for access in the library. And when you get a job called library cataloging, you do all of this stuff. It isn't just making a catalog. Catalog's one thing. The other is the shelf system for storing informational objects. Now, I make a differentiation between them. The first is a surrogate file, a file of representations of the informational objects. The second is an item file, a straight ordering of the objects themselves. And that, of course, can be book-like things, you know, and sound recordings that are very physical, but it can also be a very virtual file of the items themselves. In any case, we're going to have to do something about accessing those because you don't want to look through them serially. So we make our systems. A lot has been said recently about whether library cataloging has a future. I'm thinking of an article by William Arms back in the year 2000. It's rather interesting. He really, with great wisdom, steered a course between talking about technological advances that are kind of a mirage and just over the horizon, and those that are surprisingly with us today. But then you don't find anything about cataloging in his little prediction of the future. Clifford Lynch, also writing about the same time, had a different picture altogether, one in which, in the light of new technologies, cataloging would be marginalized, at best to occupy a little niche, and that's it. Especially in the light of algorithmic computing. And then finally, very recently, this January, Deanna Markham from the Library of Congress, writing in the latest issue of Library Resources and Technical Services, she's even more abrupt about the future of library cataloging, suggesting that in the light of Google-like search engines, it has, for all practical purposes, little future at all. Descriptive cataloging, for sure, is a goner, lost to technicians. And following that, she goes on, then retooled catalogers, I love that phrase, retooled catalogers, sounds like we're a piece of equipment that has to have a new hole drilled in it or something, could give more time to authority control, subject analysis, resource identification and evaluation, and collaboration with the information technology units on automated applications and digitization projects. I thought that's what we were supposed to be doing in the first place. Well, anyway, assuming that these comments are representative of a larger literature that has appeared, we might venture the following observations of them, just these three. First, each focus on the demise of library cataloging, but not on the demise of library catalogs. Think about that. I can only presume that catalogs will remain necessary no matter what form they take and how they're made. Second, each focuses on catalog making and especially its costs, and not also on the creation of item files, shelf arrangements. I find this to be strange. For in a very real sense, the production and maintenance of shelf classification is one of the most costly, but also one of the least rationalized activities that library catalogers do. Why do we spend all that money on those things? Third, each of these emphasize that cataloging faces an uncertain future because of the arrival of new, faster, more robust, probably sexier technologies. It's not difficult to assume in this that they view library cataloging primarily as a technology. Viewing library cataloging this way puts me to mind of old nostrums about technology. Technology is in great part a means to an end. It is not the end in and of itself. Then my mind wanders further to what in my view is one of the most delightfully absurd advertisements on television. Picture a desert. And a campfire, and some men out there, and all of a sudden you see a meteor coming. All of a sudden you also see the man in the new Nissan Titan pickup truck coming, and the meteor hits the ground and blows a gaping hole in the ground, and the truck keeps coming on through. What a truck! Well, we say, what technology? You know, I'm not sure I want to buy a truck or any vehicle because it can withstand a meteor impact. I mean, If we put aside information technology for a moment and go straight to the heart of the matter, however, we come to face with a difficult and even terrifying question. What indeed is the end or the ends that library cataloging serves? And given that we can even begin to identify that end or those ends, what possibilities exist for their implementation for the future of it? I want here to try to answer these questions, even though another little voice in me shouts out very loudly, "Fools rush in where angels fear to tread." And I want to do so in my own fashion by first indulging in a little bit of history about library cataloging. Second, by eliciting from that little bit of history what I consider to be the heart of cataloging, the genius of cataloging, its specialness as an activity. And that will be oriented around the idea of creating an intellectual space. And third, having done both of those, to offer you my own hopefully humble, probably silly suggestions for a possible future of library cataloging. But first, a little bit of history. I have suggested getting into a little bit of history because I really do believe in the idea that we can learn something from history. Understanding history gives us an opportunity to learn from it. I don't believe we can avoid mistakes because I'm not sure that things in the past are mistakes, they are experiences. At any rate, one of the problems of getting into a little history is knowing how far back to go and just how much of a little bit you can learn from. Shall we go back about 15 years to the beginning of FERBER? Any of you heard of FERBER? Functional Requirements of Bibliographic Records. It was published in 1998. It's all the rage. And appears promising to at least produce a new rendition of our cataloging rules in the near future. I have to smile. What is the matter with those FERBER people? Don't they realize descriptive cataloging is about dead? Or will be by morning? We're going to go all through it, get a new code of cataloging rules, and they're predicting the demise of cataloging. Or again, maybe we should go back four decades, 40 years, to the origins of the MARC format. And then forward from that to computerization of the library catalog. First mainframe computer catalogs, then catalogs on CD-ROMs, then OPACs, and now WebCats, and all of that. Maybe that's the history we should look at. This would at least get us into technology, whereas FERBER is such a dreadfully ethereal thing, with its focus on works, expressions, manifestations, copies, and so on. Unfortunately, neither of these, I think, will help us much, because they in effect confine us to what we have now, what we now experience in the realm of cataloging. They view library cataloging from the inside, in a certain sense, and what I would like to help us to do is to get outside our present sense of what cataloging is. And to do the latter confronts us with a really tough problem, however, because it will require us to go really way back. Why? Because present library cataloging has been around so long, it has become a thicket, a hedgerow, consisting of nearly an impenetrable intertwining of foliages of our practices. In fact, the thicket has been growing almost unattended, with little meaningful pruning for decades, for a century. It is, in fact, a 100-year-old thicket. Well, the best way I know to characterize this thicket and to get us to a point of usefulness is to reflect on a statement that a library cataloging pioneer made about a century ago. The often quoted one by Charles Cutter in the preface of the fourth edition of his Rules for a Dictionary Catalog, published in 1904. Although his remarks were actually composed in the spring or summer of the previous year just before he died. He died in September of 1903. He wrote, On seeing the great success of Library of Congress cataloging, I doubted whether it was worthwhile to prepare and issue this fourth edition of my rules. But I reflected that it would be a considerable time before all libraries would use the cards of that library, and a long time before the Library of Congress could furnish cards for all books, long enough for libraries to absorb another edition and use it up in that part of their cataloging which they must do themselves. Still, I cannot help but thinking that the golden age of cataloging is over, and that the difficulties and discussions which have furnished an innocent pleasure to so many will interest them no more. Another lost art. But it will be better for other parts of the service, the children's rooms and the information desk, perhaps. Now, he wrote that in 1903. What a striking statement. What an epitaph for an age. But then again, does it not sound familiar? A new technology comes along and poof, there goes what we've been doing. Of course, we may rightly ask if that's all there is to it. In this respect, we need first to think about what this new technology consisted of that spelled such an end to things for Cutter. And incidentally, that led to what I have already characterized as a century-long thicket that related to our cataloging practices. Second, we need to contrast that new technology with what Cutter himself had experienced in a career of some 40 years so as to get a handle on what he really thought was lost. In the process of the latter, I am hopeful that we shall see some things that are incredibly applicable to our own time. There should be little mystery about what the new technology that Cutter was speaking about, at least if we have any background in the history of library cataloging. It was, of course, the appearance in 1901 of Library of Congress printed cards, printed catalog cards, and the service that the Library of Congress had instituted with that the appearance of those cards of making copies of them and selling them to libraries at a very, very reasonable cost. We're talking about like a tenth of a cent per card or something. It actually represented a new technology of printed cards. Printed cards. First of all, it's cards. Now, card catalogs had been instituted on and off among different libraries since the 1880s. So they're about 20 years old. And here comes along. Here comes printed cards, because a lot of the card catalogs they had were handwritten. They didn't have the technology to print cards either. The linotype, which is the basic print technology for printed catalog cards, was only invented in the early 1890s. You could make lines of type and then do the whole thing, throw it away, and if you have to make them over again, it's not so bad, you know. And Cutter must have been rueful. Because he had been involved about 10 years before in a technological startup company, the Rudolph Indexer Company, that was, the whole idea was to distribute printed catalog cards and then put them in a nice little machine that you could crank around, and the catalog would have been a machine with a crank and the cards would keep appearing for you. And he was part of that startup, and it crashed and burned. Mainly because of some shenanigans by Melville Dewey, who didn't want the competition for his library bureau. And then the library bureau, you see, they started producing their own cards, and then when the Rudolph Indexer Company crashed, they quit doing theirs. So they wiped out the competition in one fell stroke. And Cutter and Dewey never talked to each other again, I don't think. And it had been a dream for 2 decades to have some way of distributing copy like that. This new system of the Library of Congress cards was a new entry system, a new access point system as well. It was called the unit record system, in which one created one basic full record in printed format, and that became the basis of all subsequent entries. For example, titles, other persons, subjects, for the same item. You would have a card, you would have five copies of it, The first one would be the author entry, then you'd type the subject heading across the top of the next one and type the title across the top of the next one. Sound familiar? If you've ever seen a card catalog anywhere, you'll know that this is the technology it uses. And though it may not be familiar to some of you, in fact, when you go to work with the MARC format, you will be doing so in a unit record system format. The MARC format is based on the unit record system. In short, MARC is not simply 40 years old, it is a century old. The format that is embedded in the MARC data structure is a century old. I talked about a 100-year-old ticket, you see. At least in terms of its core data structure and many of the elements in the typical display of that data. One might also add to this that the new system also included the notations of still another new Library of Congress product, its classification numbers from the brand new Library of Congress classification scheme. It would take a while before the schedules of the system would be substantially completed, another 15 years for most of them, and then another 30 years for all the rest of them. It would also take about three more decades before the Library of Congress would also print Dewey Decimal classification numbers on the cards, about the 1930s. But think of it. You could, in effect, get your cataloging already done for a fraction of the cost of the salary of one employee. Does that not sound familiar? Of course, then the last thing that's really dynamic about it is that it reduced creative local cataloging to copy cataloging versus original cataloging. All of this happened 100 years ago. Actually, Cutter was not all that troubled by the change from one point of view because he had had such difficulty staffing his library. He was at the Forbes Library in Northampton, Massachusetts at the time. The Forbes legacy that had built his library in a manner similar to Carnegie grants had allowed all this money for a building, a lot of money for collecting new books, and none for operations. And money was dear because they'd had a depression in 1893. That was really devastating. Now, what in fact did these elements of the new technology really presage? What did they really represent or eventually turn out to be? I have talked about a 100-year thicket. Let's talk about that a little bit more. They are not actually so important individually as in how they fit together to form what amounted to a different technology and system for a catalog. It's a whole system that it was invented at that time. And not simply a different system, but when viewed over time, what can only be characterized as a given system. In fact, the one given system in which all cataloging would eventually participate and all cataloging would eventually follow. It redefined what cataloging was. It redefined it as learning how to deal with the one given system. Once this system got underway, it became a de facto standard. It wasn't copied and used right away by everybody, but within 40 years it was. A given entity and way of thinking to which the library catalog community specifically and the library community in general came to restrict itself. The effects of it have been immensely significant for library cataloging, in the minds of some, just plain dreadful to the library cataloging community. For not simply the next decade or two, but for an entire century. For example, cataloging work would come to mean no more nor less than learning how to input into the one given system. True, some aspects of the matter of inputting are very interesting and creative in their own right. The extension of a given system, say, to new kinds of informational objects. When map cataloging appeared, it was kind of exciting. Within the given system. When they really got into cataloging audiovisual materials in the 1960s, yeah, it was kind of interesting. And sometimes it's just plain interesting because you're trying to use the given system for foreign language materials of kinds that have never been done. CJK, Chinese, Japanese, Korean efforts in cataloging have been interesting. I mean, it's just a new area I haven't quite conquered yet, you know? But the interest factor only goes so far, because the one given system does not allow all that much latitude and frowns upon what in the end violates its basic principles. What would happen, for example, if a local cataloger learned that main access points, that beginning part, the 100 field and mark, of a personal author was not really very important for a given group of materials? Well, could you handle that? You'd have to rearrange the data structure. Golly, would that get you in trouble? I mean, first of all, you wouldn't have any rules to go to, because the rules are based on the idea that you got to have a main entry of a personal author. Now, I ran into a situation like this in consulting one time. It wasn't really consulting. I just went and visited some people that asked me to come down and talk with them. They were at a state legislative reference library. And what did they have as a collection but thousands of documents from other state agencies, from all the states, you know, in the whole region. And people looked up things by the agencies and the agency focus and didn't give a darn about the name of the author. Well, that requires a different thinking system, a different way of approaching what a data structure should be for it. And I had to sadly say, I don't have any rules to recommend to you. You'd have to create it yourself. And they, in fact, tried, but they finally succumbed to the given system because it was easier. And there was nobody around that could really devote the time to do it. The second thing is that cataloging instruction over the next few decades would become an adjunct to the one given system. An incredible foray into details of its data structure and display, with no serious discussion of, say, the logic or necessity of its parts. For example, individual rules or groups of cataloging rules became important to sometimes even to memorize for some teachers. You know, memorize the rules. God, that is just awful. But such instruction came to end. Oh, the other side of it is that in the card catalog display, a lot people got into this thing where you had to have it displayed. You know, the card format, while not only being essential to the data structure of a card catalog, is also the display structure. And cataloging instructors get bent out of shape if you space too far over. I mean, you got all involved in how to type the cards. But such instruction came to have little time for examining the necessity of the rules or examining the phenomena upon which they were based. That's what Patrick Wilson, who's really a very significant figure in the history of cataloging, even though he only taught cataloging for a couple of years, and he cataloged maps for a couple of years when he was younger, but he just struggled with cataloging because it had no abstractness to it. There wasn't any principles that anybody was really working with. When he was an instructor, he was more inclined to ask not what rules should be used for this or that situation, but why should such a rule even exist, and could another be devised that would be much better for it? He just asked questions all the time. And of course, other cataloging instructors at the same school, it was Berkeley, just got all bent out of shape, because he wasn't teaching the given system. Also, cataloging research and thinking would become, over the next few decades, confined to the view from within the given system. And there was some beginnings of that in the 1930s with the work of Julia Petit, and much more since the 1950s, and since by Seymour Lubetzky, Patrick Wilson, and more recently Ferber devotees, as well as by those who develop MARC and online cataloging. But it's like looking outside always through one window and never opening the door and going outside and looking for yourself out there and exploring around. A concerted effort to stay inside the box. This has been especially the case in how we view informational objects. Ferber is essentially based on a study of bibliographic records. It is not based on a study of the actual objects that the records represent. Now, there was some statistical work and a lot of good work done by Richard Smaraglia, in which he actually tried to come to some conclusions on the thing, but even he had to say, you know, I'm not going to go out and examine all those objects myself. I'm going to use bibliographic records and do statistical runs on the data that they hold. But that presupposes that the bibliographic records have, in fact, faithfully represented the objects, and the object, we understand what the purposes of the objects are in the first place. So, again, in the given system, we have research that's from an inside view. It never gets out and looks at itself from a larger point of view. Also, finally, I think it's finally, in this century-long development, we have views of catalog users would become essentially epiphenomenal. They would be little pictures in our minds about users, but nothing ever based on going out and finding out about users for real. I did a survey of views of the user in a research library, which will remain unnamed. And this is about 20 years ago now, I guess. And it was a rather interesting experience, because when I came to the catalogers, their vision of the users, it was almost like anthropological interviewing of people, you know, just kind of getting, what are you thinking about when you're thinking about users? And that was card catalog days still at this university library. And their vision of a user was fingers turning and flipping catalog cards. But we have since had visions of users that are little more than fingers making keystrokes. And there's no more reality to it than that. No wonder that when in the 1960s the library and information field began to discover new ideas with the influx of scientists and mathematicians into our field, and new technologies with the advent of computerization, there was such difficulty with it by the cataloging community and the library community in general. This was likely the case because the presuppositions of those newly arrived people and the uses to which the new technologies could be put depended on a broad-ranging and different ontology of informational objects and their use. I could ask a question of the digital age. What happens to our idea of informational objects and, of course, catalogs and shelf arrangements that represent informational objects when any given informational object, that is, for example, a text or something, can be parsed not simply into individual grammatical parts but into individual digital signals? What is the ontology of it then? How do we think about using it then? Questions like this did not get asked except by the newcomers. And they weren't particularly adept in building bridges from their viewpoint to that of the library cataloging community. In fact, that still holds. That people with a technological sense and the background for that often don't seem to be able to translate their ideas into, you know, what is teaching? Is it not building bridges to other people's minds? Transforming the language that you're using to be able to communicate to someone else. And that's just not been done. Of course, it hasn't been done between information science and computer science and a whole lot of realms, but that is the case. No wonder that the idea of information retrieval and information science in many schools and for the cataloging community at large was converted into the much more constrained realm of library automation. That's what information retrieval turned into in schools of library and information science in the 70s and in the early 80s. It isn't that library automation hasn't been important. It's rather that when it substitutes this meaning for the broader realm of what computerized information storage and retrieval really got into, it artfully dodges the latter, keeping it inside its own box, so to speak. No wonder that criticism of library cataloging began so soon after the advent of computers in libraries, in the 1970s, and that judgments regularly promulgated that computers would replace cataloging led to that great downsizing of professional cataloging staffs ever since, or to their outsourcing of their work. Present criticism of the end of cataloging is not new. It's been around for 30 years, but it sure is getting more forceful all the time. All of what I just said is the thicket that we come to library cataloging with that makes it so difficult to think about library cataloging in any other terms than this, because we have to go so far back and outside to get at what it is that we're really doing. We need to ask, however, what Cutter thought he really lost when the thicket got planted. Cutter spoke of what was being lost by the new subsystem as a golden age of cataloging, and as a province of difficulties and discussions which have furnished an innocent pleasure to so many. That's an interesting way to say it. But he said, of course, they would interest them no more. Having been an incredible and an adept ironist in his writing, you know, he had something in the neighborhood of 400 articles, reviews, books. The man was a writing machine. And when he wrote anonymously, which was not unusual in the 19th century, oh, man, did he put the knife in. He was right in your face. But he liked irony, and one must take this statement of his with a certain amount of salt. It is a masterful understatement of what he and others had really experienced. Experience that inputting into and maintaining a given system would in fact eradicate. Cutter had spent more than 40 years as a cataloger in this broader sense with which I began, one who creates both surrogate and item files. He began at Harvard Divinity School about 1856, where he served as a librarian while attending the school. He was the student librarian of the Harvard Divinity School. It wasn't very big then, but he was still the librarian. And this ratchets up a notch when one realizes that he was 18 when he finished college in 1855 and 19 when he started Divinity School. So he's pretty young. His first introduction to the work of cataloging was to revise a handwritten book catalog. Have you ever seen one? A handwritten book catalog. Actually, it was multiple hands, so it's kind of hard to read. It had been around for so long that so many handwritings were in it, you could hardly read it. That featured shelf marks from a fixed location classification system. That means they just referred to the place on the shelves where the book was supposed to be. His response was to write a new catalog and do some shelf rearranging. Not much, but it appears to have gotten him thinking, and you know, about the whole process, because he became friends with Ezra Abbott in the Harvard College Library, who was just then embarking on a new catalog venture that was dynamic. After graduating in 1859 to a stunning commencement address that year by the Unitarian Henry Whitney Bellows, who called for young men to participate in a national cultural mission that could be expressed in other ways than being a parish minister, like being a librarian was quite a good expression of ministry, and also after trying the idea of ministry for a year, apparently he wasn't real good in the pulpit, he was a congregational minister, and also after turning down an instructorship in a theological seminary in Pittsburgh or western Pennsylvania somewhere, he joined the Harvard College Library staff in 1861. There he would work closely with Ezra Abbott to help engineer the latter's experiment in cataloging, a revision of the Harvard catalog into an alphabetical class catalog on cards, handwritten, but it was on cards, and this was only 1861, and it was alphabetical classed, which I won't go into. That's a pretty sophisticated structure compared to what they had been trying to do. A strikingly new technology and way to think about catalogs and the cataloging process. Cutter actually did not just work on it for the next 8 years. He was its chief engineer because Ezra Abbott was really a biblical scholar and a whole really busy doing that kind of thing. He was responsible for the American Standard Version of the Bible and everything. And so, yes, he worked on it a little bit. Cutter did the work. Cutter also got married in this period, and you know how that goes. More money is always welcome. So he got a second job cataloging evenings at the Boston Public Library under C.C. Jewett, who was one of the great code writers of the 19th century. Jewett was implementing a class list-based approach to the catalog, and among other things, Cutter helped to create its innovative guides to reading built right into the cataloging. Wow, that's an interesting thing. I wonder if we, what would happen if we tried that with our catalog? In 1869, Cutter went to the Boston Athenaeum. Now, that's a really hoity-toity library. That is Boston Brahmin, Boston Blue Blood. Anybody who was anybody in American literature and history in the last century probably had a share. It's a share library. You had to have a family share in it. You could still buy a share if you had a very large sum of money. But he became the librarian there in 1869, and for the next 13 years engineered its catalog. They had a catalog revision underway, and he took it over, and he turned it into that magnificent, compact, absolutely syndetic, five-volume printed creation called the Dictionary Catalog of the Boston Athenaeum. And if you really want to see something, that is a marvelous system. You ought to look at that. It is two-thirds of a cubic foot of absolute, everything's connected. And what a display. He created that. Of course, thinker, dabbler, and perfectionist that he was, his postscript in the last volume suggests strongly that much more could have been done. His board of trustees, by the way, complained about the catalog as it came to completion. Its first volume was published in 1874 and its last in 1882. One of them just said, well, we asked for a cottage and you built us a mansion, and now we have to pay for the mansion. I think they figured the catalog cost $125,000. In those days, that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple of million today. By the way, the library only had 70,000 volumes. But it had 100,000 pamphlets. And a lot of the volumes in the library were serials, and everything in it was analyzed. What we call analytical cataloging. Every part to every serial to every larger multi-work item was represented in it. He not only created a striking entry and description system, it was a principal entry system, not unit record system, for the catalog. Now famously encapsulated in his rules, and he wrote his rules, by the way, which he wrote in 1876, so he wasn't even done with the catalog, but his rules, the first edition, have a running commentary talking about what he's doing. It's the only set of rules ever written in the history of rulemaking that has the author saying why he's doing and what he could do, or he could try this, he could try that, but he tried this, and here's the rationale for it, and it's just shot through with that kind of thing. He opened his mind up to the reader of the rules. And maybe the most marvelous thing is that he didn't conceptualize it as a catalog with all sorts of different entries. He conceptualized it as the merging of four separate catalog structures. One for authors, one for titles, one for subjects, and one for genre. He also did yeoman's work on how to display the result in a printed card catalog, printed book catalog context. He had printing equipment installed, hired a printer, and then spent hours and hours designing, planning, and adjusting the use of typefaces, space, indentions, and the like to make what can only be considered a masterful display. It was an interface design, let's face it. And the huge amount of data involved, one that employed a wide variety of affordances. And this was in the 1870s. And somehow toward the end of that project, he had time to start creating a sensible relative location book classification system of the kind that Dewey pioneered 3 years before, but was really minuscule. You know, the first edition of Dewey, the whole thing was only 40 pages long with index and notes and explanations. The schedules were 12 pages. and Cutter start writing his own in 1879. Actually, he planned a joint system with Dewey. They were going to do it together, but that collapsed when Dewey was taken to court for mishandling ALA funds. He was named in the suit against Dewey. I guess he could hardly keep going with him, you know. He ended up creating not one but two separate systems, the first for the Boston Athenaeum and the second a much broader ranging system called the Expansive Classification. He began his classificatory venture in 1879 and he died with it incomplete in 1903, having lived, eaten, and breathed classification every day for more than 20 years. Also, by the way, he had time to create two different versions of his alphabetical ordering tables and sponsor the creation of a third with Kate Sanborn, his famous Cutter numbers, which probably have immortalized his name. In 1894, after falling afoul of a new board of trustees at the Athenaeum, after helping to get the idea of the Rudolph Indexer Company off the ground, although it collapsed, after spending a year traveling in Europe and, among other things, buying books for the newly created Forbes Library Trust in Northampton, Massachusetts, he returned to become the new librarian at the latter and began still another catalog. This one from scratch. Oh, and by the way, while doing all of what I just talked about, he had time to serve very actively on committees of the ALA, including the Cooperation Committee, which used his library as a test bed for new products for libraries, because there were no products out there for libraries. All this thing about how big the card was, they tested that in his library. Also, he served for 2 years as ALA president, 1887-9, helped to get the second edition of Poole's Index for Periodical Literature planned, completed, and published, participated in experiments, as I said, in cooperative cataloging with other libraries, edited the Library Journal for 14 years, and wrote something in the neighborhood of 400 articles, book reviews, and so on and so forth. And he died, as I mentioned, of a heart attack in 1903 at the age of 66, in full harness, galloping at full speed. In the end, he spoke of all of this as a golden age and made passing reference to some difficulties and discussions. What an understatement. What he had in fact experienced with library cataloging full bore. By the way, that phrase came to me, and I couldn't figure out where it came from. And I think it comes from racing, auto racing. You know, full bore means at maximum power and speed at the same time. And that has that requires you to shape your pistons in a car in a certain way, how far they stroke, how wide they are, and everything. But what he had experienced with library cataloging, full bore in all of what it might be if it were not constrained by a given system. It was an activity that required, and I say this in no particular order, actively investigating client patterns and looking for informational objects, planning entry and description data structures out of a rich awareness of options available, and that had to be built in such a way as to be related to informational objects on the one hand and clients' needs on the other, planning and executing display of data, in short, creating an interface design with the primary tools at his disposal being printing techniques, printing technology and fonts, and book design. Working out cost of a catalog in terms of technology, institutional needs, and all the usual suspects. Creating options in the use of the physical medium of catalogs because he had dealt with and worked with handwritten, printed book, and then printed card catalogs, in which each, in effect, used a different approach to the idea of the data to be recorded and how it was displayed. Creating a classificatory side of the catalog and a classification system for his item files that gave evidence of an extraordinary investment in time and thoughtfulness, and by the way, constant adjustment. I could say more of all of this. He, too, would have said more of it, too, but he kept his remarks modest, as befitted his essentially modest personality. Except that when he wrote anonymously, as I mentioned, he wielded a sword every bit as sharp as that of Damocles. Full bore cataloging. How many of us have taught this in the library school? How many of us have been taught this in a library school? Perhaps some elements of it, but frankly, the demands of the one given system have precluded either much attention to it or even much need of it. Usually with the cry, our students don't need that. Or the students say it themselves. They say, all we need is a little mark and how to find and use copy. Well, no wonder people talk about library cataloging being in death throes. We stripped it of anything that is at its heart. On the other hand, it strikes me that we can learn something from Mr. Cutter's experience about library cataloging, but we have to get at a more abstract level. We have to transcend his immediate experiences to a level of abstraction that is transferable. After all, few of us will ever be called on to shape specific technologies of the kind that he used. We're not going to be using print technologies and lead type and things like that like he used. So I will proceed in this more abstract direction, but under the label of what I call the genius of cataloging. More specifically, I will present some thoughts on library cataloging as the act of creating a unique intellectual space that serves library clientele. In 1994, Phil Doty and I, he's a colleague of mine at Texas, presented a paper at the first digital library conference in which we attempted to answer the question, why should a digital library be called a library? We did so by focusing on the preliminary question, what in fact is a library? In the course of the paper, we did some sleight of hand by first stating that since one of the attributes of a library is that it is found in a place, but place is one of the things that began to melt away for a digital library, place needed to be reinterpreted, and we reinterpreted it as something intellectual. It's an intellectual place. In short, one of the attributes of a library is that it has an intellectual space as a place. 2 years later, I extended the idea a little more by using it in the context of explaining the modern library's cultural legacy by referring to two locales of the library in the same way, that is, the library as a private space on the one hand and as a public space on the other hand. Here I wish to push the idea of space a little further, still by referring to what library cataloging does, or at least helps to do, in constructing an intellectual space that a library in effect summons into existence. It was clearly what Cutter was doing, and it is clearly at the heart of what library cataloging does if it's done as library cataloging, at least when it's conducted in its full bore manner. 2 points before I start, though, and that is that I have to say something. What do I mean by this intellectual space? I think it has two especially important attributes. First, it is surely an idea. It's or the confluence of several ideas, being fundamentally an intellectual thing, a thing of the mind. An intellectual space also has tendrils that are firmly established in the real world. And of all such tendrils, the most significant are those that are anchored in informational objects, in informational object users, and in the agencies, in this case libraries, whether physically real or simply virtual, that have as their primary purpose to bring informational objects and informational object users together. Second, this intellectual space is logical. It is logical not in the sense of rigorous mathematical logic or classical logic, but rather in the sense of being ordered. And we're using logic in a very loose sense here. Purposefully arranged, structured in some useful way, probably everyday manner, and in fact responds to the real lives of real people. Or to at least what we conceptualize as their real lives. One aspect of this space is that it facilitates what I think Don Norman was talking about in his the psychology or the use of the practical use of everyday things, that it facilitates helping people to have mental models of the relationships of the informational objects in it. In sum, the intellectual space of which I speak is a mental conception, a mental conception that concerns the relationships and symbolism of real things, books, periodicals, graphics, motion pictures, and so on and so forth. People who use or have the need of such things, and the library agency that brings them together, that has order to it, that is purposeful and forceful, though not necessarily logical to any rigorous definition. How does this conception of intellectual space show up in Cutter's experiences and activities of his full-bore approach in cataloging? I think this can be seen by considering the three basic categories of phenomena behind what he was doing: the objects, the users, and the organizational systems that the agency supported for him. The first inhabitant that Cutter was involved with was informational objects. They were not just randomly there. They didn't just happen into the space. They would have been culled from a much larger universe of informational objects, though through some purposeful method of selection and acquisition, or however the process went. And they would have been there for reasons obvious, but most likely tacit as well, because they represented something of significance. They were objects that were venerated in our culture as an element of the West, as an element of the European Enlightenment. He's only 80 years away from the end of what we call the European Enlightenment. And operational, these things we collect were for him, for his library, for libraries that were coming into existence in the middle and late 19th century, an operational base for societal advance. They were important. And they were also an operational base for the education of the general public in terms of what reading did to them when they read them. They had a mission for the mental cultivation of people who read good books. There's a lot of likeness with the tradition of bibliography, the tradition of the information organization called bibliography. He himself, Cutter, was a bookman who had an informative education, actually in Scottish common sense philosophy, which is the basis for his thinking, and in its faculty psychology. The goals of the modern library movement were to deliver the best books by the best authors to a public who, in reading them, would become mentally cultivated. There can be little question that he subscribed to this. Now, that was their goal. When you give a book to a person, it wasn't the matter of they can use the book to do something with it, which is a very practical use of a book or an informational object. It was what it would do to them. That's what the focus of the library movement was. And to deliver books in the form of a classified structure, in the form of a classified structure, because the knowledge represented in books themselves referred to elements of the universe of knowledge, which was considered, in fact, naturally classified. And this was their belief system. In the latter respect, one of the most fundamental reasons for creating a collection of informational objects, of making a library, over the long haul of human history has been because they represent the human mind expressing knowledge. Not in the sense of contributing pieces to a human knowledge jigsaw puzzle, but rather in the sense of expressing cohesive sets and sequences of ideas. I think that's really what Ferber is talking about, called works that reflect the experience of their authors of the world, or the experience of others' accounts of the world. If human culture as extended experience is to survive, it is important to make such experiences available and encourage people to read them. This is part of their rationale. It helps if the ones of the informational objects made available are the best written by the best expressors of knowledge. And if you think this is a dead thing, consider all of the local movements today in the United States that are trying to get us to appreciate this group or that group's culture, whether it's Native Americans or African Americans or whatever. The whole notion is we ought to be able to see something of and experience something of their experience of the world. And so also, that's what we were doing, that's what books meant for them, informational objects. The users, Cutter's intellectual space also incorporated informational object users, and he expressed his ideas in this respect not once but twice. He has two different approaches to users. The first occurs when he characterizes users in terms of how they should be able to search the catalog, his well-known objectives or objects of the catalog. Catalogers should be able to search for individual informational objects by means of one or more clues. We call that a known item search today. Catalog users should be able to search for categories of informational objects. He named three category types that they should be able to search by: all the books on a subject, all the books by an author, and all the books in a particular genre. We could extend that by all kinds of categories. Finally, catalog users should be able to choose among their hits on the basis of details. He would actually have liked to include details of merit. This is a really tough book to read. This is a crappy book to read. I mean, he would have put it all in if he could have. He based this hit list of searching objectives on his notes on listening to his users. There's a long article by him called Library Catalogs in the 1876 Special Report on Libraries. It's 100 pages long, and it's, as far as I know, the first or one of the first list, a data list of catalogs of libraries. It's 70 pages long of data on libraries catalogs that people sent him because he did a survey. He did survey research in 1875. And he at the very beginning of the article, he actually asked questions. He said, this is the way we find out what a catalog is supposed to do. And he listed all these questions that people ask of the librarian. And you know what? They're his objects of a catalog in the form of user questions. He was listening to his users. He also expressed another picture of users based not on the kind of specific searches they should do, but rather on the mental ability to think classified, on their capacity of users to approach their searching in terms of a systematic structure. And he had three classes of users: fully systematically minded searchers, real scholars. They conducted every search in their minds within the context of a systematic structure of knowledge. Then we had somewhat systematically minded searchers. Actually, we would call them specialists today, whose knowledge was more confined to some portion of the systematic whole, and they conducted their searches within that confine. And then the third category of users were desultory users, and they didn't have a clue. The problem is the desultory users outnumbered all the others. So he had to make a catalog that started with them. So that's good economics. And what he did was arrange everything in the catalog alphabetically to make hits right on specific subjects, but you can't read that as little subjects. You have to read that as concrete subjects. That's what he meant by it. And on particular authors, and he didn't use title entry nearly as much as on automatically as we do, some titles and form or genre. He had to base his catalog on the desultory users, and he had to figure out how to serve the other two classes of users in some other way. And then he brought these two ways of speaking of catalog users together in the form of his syndetic dictionary catalog system in a printed catalog context. His rules, by the way, were entitled Rules for a Printed Dictionary Catalog when the first edition came out. And I'm not going to go through the details of that, but it's pretty sophisticated. And I will say one thing of it. Part of it is subject headings. And you will read in the literature that our subject heading system came from Charles Cutter and his subject heading in the rules. And that is totally not right. The Library of Congress intervened and made the subject heading system something quite different than he had invented, because his was for a different technology, printed book catalogs, and he had a different way of displaying the data. And in fact, the very existence of cards where you put subject heading on top of every card led to the idea of a string of terms, which he never used. The whole thing's a different approach that you find in the Library of Congress subject heading system. The result is, of course, that beautiful and quite logical space called the printed catalog of the Boston Athenaeum, the Boston Athenaeum catalog. There is more power in it, despite its dated rationales, than any modern catalog I have ever seen. And I encourage you to go look at that thing. It is really some kind of a masterpiece. Are there any discontinuities in what he did? Sure, there were. He didn't solve all the problems. There, you know, he said that he was saying, in effect, that when we search, we should encourage searching within the concept of a systematically classified universe of knowledge, but there was no systematic classification to be had at that point. He's starting his own, but that's a different matter. And how could he have characterized Boston Athenaeum users the way he did? They weren't desultory readers. They were educated people, which either means that they weren't so educated as we think, or he was projecting to people outside of his library, which then puts a different complexion on some of this. Why did he emphasize works by authors and contribute to the tradition of making a template in cataloging, that the most important things we catalog are that which has one container having one work, especially a good work written by a good author, and then we force everything into that template, especially what I call anthological works, works that have more anthological informational objects. They have more than one work in them. And I would say today that at least 50% of everything a library owns is anthological. And yet we're using this template which says one-to-one correspondence packaged to work is the model. That's what Ferber is doing. You look in Ferber, they don't have anything really serious attention to what's inside of serials, to what's inside of conference proceedings, to what's inside of collections of things. It's like they don't realize where their ideas came from at all. What about people who don't want full works? They just want the piece of information in the work that serves their purposes. Surely he had the experience of that. Surely he had done some of that. There's nothing in his objectives of a catalog that say, find, you know, to enable the user to find a piece of information out of a particular book or source. Why isn't that there? Did they have blinders on? Well, we could go on and give the man a hard time. How do we extrapolate to the present day? I've already run long here, but I'm going to try to list three or four things I think would be useful starting points, at least. They're possibilities only. From the point of view of the future of cataloging, they're necessities, though, because we better do something. Or, in fact, cataloging is dead. Because it lost its soul, I guess, or something. It's lost its genius, which is to create the space for our users. I think, to start with, we have to have a commitment to the ideal of constructing a useful intellectual space with a catalog system, or whatever we call it. And that means a structured logical space of some kind. I don't mean just a list in alphabetical order that comes from full-text indexing. I'm talking about something that has sense and relationships built into it. And if we don't think that's necessary or useful or it's too expensive, then it's done. We're done. We can stop right here. That's what the idea of library cataloging was supposed to be. We just happen to be on the other side of a 100-year thicket that says no, the one given system. And as long as you have the one given system and everybody did the creative work on what supposedly was its intellectual space 100 years ago, we don't have anything to contribute to it. In this view of the cataloger's task, there is little room for people who cannot think beyond simply implementing the given system. Think of it. Inviting people onto your staff on the basis of their ability to participate in creating and implementing a space like that. Golly, that would be exciting. That would be worth working for. I might even do that with not a whole lot of money because it was interesting. You know that old saw about the job you need is the job that you can say, I can't believe they pay me for doing this. And that's a good way to talk about job satisfaction. You're not so worried about what you get for it as the fact that it is really interesting. Second thing, at some time, someone is going to have to break down and begin the study of the informational objects we represent in catalogs and the way people use such informational objects. That's the basis for creating the space. And library cataloging doesn't study the objects. I think some new aspects of information retrieval are attempting to study the objects. I think in music work, I think there's a little bit going on that way with like Stephen's work, but you take the typical stuff that we gather from the universe of informational objects, and we don't study them, not seriously. On informational objects, I can't see how library cataloging can put off any longer the enormous problem of not treating anthological objects. That's just it's just a big gaping pit in the middle of library cataloging. To not treat, I mean, they'll say, oh, you have to do that by analytical cataloging, and we can't afford that, but there's more to it than that. There's a political issue going on here. I don't see how library cataloging can avoid any longer the reality that some informational objects are or can be used for the kind of question-answering systems that have become so basic to web search systems. You know, some people in certain information retrieval situations don't want a whole object. And our systems give them whole objects and don't give them the point in it that's useful. Now, on the other hand, I don't think we really have to, it's not an all or nothing thing. It's not like, we did it this way, and now we have to shift to full text indexing or something like that. That's not the issue. We can choose. We can be choosy. Maybe there's a subset of the whole that if we did full text indexing on in a library context, it would be a terrific question answering system. Nobody's chewed on that one, but it sure sounds like a possibility to me. On overall search objectives, it seems to me that we would do well to have some other way of thinking about the usefulness of a catalog than as simply a mechanism for getting books in the hands of our clients. It does that, but it does some other things too. I have long spoken of and tried to get students and others interested into the fact that one use of the catalog and of the intellectual space that it generates, and also for shelf classification, is for users to explore ideas. In short, a catalog is not only used as a finding list, maybe that's its ultimate use, but the other use that it has is that of this idea exploration device. If one were to follow up Robert Taylor's idea of a retrieval system that needs a negotiation space, and Belkin and Adi's idea of anomalous states of knowledge, it seems to me that surely the catalog is often used by our clients simply to work through some idea for themselves. They are grasping. They want to get a clearer picture of what it is that they're actually interested in. They don't know how to think about it. And yet we run the catalog like it's a gong show. You either find something or you don't. And it rings the bell and you're wrong, you know. At the present time, users use catalogs for this. But the catalog's not, as presently set up, not very good for the task. Seems to me we ought to be building separate systems that help people to explore ideas in their relationships. And don't burden it down with all the entries of the catalog at first. Make it a system for exploring ideas in order to help them in query clarification. It is here, and not in reinstituting the 19th century ideal of a classified universe of knowledge, that we could get some real help from classification. Why is it that library cataloging hides the structure of its tools from the public? If you say for someone to do a subject search in the catalog, can they go to the subject heading system in a separate display and see how all the subjects are related that they're interested in? And I don't mean menus. I'm talking about visual displays that are interesting. We could have star clusters. We could have sequence and time structures for the things. Draw them out as a map. A picture is worth 1,000 words. Why don't we do that with our subject headings? We can't give them that damn six-volume set, the red books, and expect them to get anything out of it. It's an authority file. And they don't know what all those things in it mean. Why don't we take our classification systems and make them available? You know, we've never made our classification systems available to the public, really. We say, oh, they experience them going through the shelves. That's not the way you learn and make use of a classification system. You make use of it in the telescoping structures of its hierarchy, if that's what it uses. But there too, we could make all kinds of displays using classification systems. For what? For helping people to think about what it is they're interested in. I think that's all part of library cataloging. You know, our use of classification is really pathetic. We really use it in our libraries as an inventory system. It's a mark and park system. It isn't. We don't care if it gets out of kilter. And then we claim people need it for browsing. But we've got it so fractured in places from disuse and misapplication. It's pathetic. Why do we spend all that money on it if we're not going to use it as a classification scheme? I think we need to, in use of classification, pursue two objectives. One of them is to use classification as for classified catalogs. Ooh, someone's going to say, don't want to do that. That was tried and found wanting. No, it was dumped 100 years ago, and a lot of politics involved, too. You know, you ever notice that people use call number searching now? Because they've inputted the call numbers into the system, and you can search by call number? Okay. They can search your shelf list. This is what it amounts to. Why not have multiple call numbers, just like we have multiple subject headings? Then you think of the power that could be displayed. There are a lot of complications with that. Don't get me wrong. That's a hard thing to do. And I don't mean simple enumerative schemes like the LC classification or Dewey. I'm talking about really top-shelf faceted structures that operate like relational databases, and you can move things around with them. The second part of this is that, well, my emphasis is not inflicting old-fashioned schemes, old-fashioned in the sense of formerly made schemes. I don't mean necessarily that they're wrong. The other side of it is that let's face the fact that in classification we have gotten beyond the blight of the period in which everybody was searching for the one best system. We understand now something about classification. It's kind of got a relative base. You could make it several, you know, lots of different alternatives. Well, let's give them the alternatives in the sense of at least clarifying their ideas and maybe for putting entries with them as well. Give them alternatives, our users. Let the intellectual space say, press this button and you'll get a different picture of the same stuff in a different set of relationships. Talk about the power of the thing. Alternatives to classification are quite fine. I would say the more the merrier. Social classifications, topic maps contributed by specialists, brief ontologies and taxonomies of smaller specialist areas. Let's give them a whole bunch of starting points. I'm going to quit. I want to close with a story, though, and it has to do, if we're going to use classification, with the relationship of classification to the librarian, to the intellectual space. And it's a little story about one of our classification theory pioneers. We rarely hear about it. But he really had some startling ideas about classification and how those are employed in a library's situation. His name is Ernest Cushing Richardson, and the words that I really found interesting of his were given at a class in the first library school in 1887. And then he published it in the Library Journal. He told the students that as librarians they needed to be encyclopedia. I mean, that's the way I it was in shorthand, so I transcribed it, and it comes out to be the word encyclopedia, not encyclopedic. but it doesn't matter because what he's really talking about is having a classified view of knowledge. The librarian needs to have a classified view of knowledge. Why? Well, nobody knows this, but library classification schemes for shelf arrangement were not for the public. The public didn't go to the shelves when they were invented. Well, if they weren't for the public, who were they for? They were for the librarians. To have this the encyclopedic view of knowledge comes from the Enlightenment period, where they were trying to make encyclopedias that gave a sense of the whole and its relationships, its interrelationships. And he said, you've got to be that way as a librarian. You've got to have that in your head. When someone comes to the delivery desk, that's what they called it in those days, and ask for subject materials or genre materials, and you got to be able to translate that into this structure and its relationships. Can't you imagine school librarians being concerned about when students want this or that kind of book, that they can put it into a structure of the whole? That's what librarians are supposed to be doing. That's what catalogers are supposed to be doing. That's what the vision of intellectual space was in the 19th century, and there's no reason we can't translate that to the 20th, but in 20th century terms. Well, I don't know if these suggestions mean much, but it's a vision of cataloging that goes far beyond the given system and the thicket. It comes from a little bit of history. I hope it gives you some thoughts to... It's not going to be my generation that does this. It's going to be yours. And if you don't do it, forget about library cataloging as a job. Okay? I'd be happy to. We've got a couple of minutes left. See, I manage to use up all the time, so I don't have to answer questions. No. Dave?
Yeah. The very technologies that are pointed to as supposed to be signaling the cataloging, when they're deployed, they bring with them their own sets of resource description problems. These are areas where there are intellectual objects, but they're at a granularity that is remote from the traditional monograph and method of distribution, assembled traditional publishing. The communities of users that are coming back may not fit our views of how we imagine library users. And yet, it seems to me that if cataloging reform were as energetic as you are prescribing, there are a lot of opportunities to come up with
some
creative intellectual spaces.
Did you get the sense of his comment that, you know, that the new technologies deal with informational objects differently at a granularity that was never imagined in previous technologies and never imagined for informational objects? I had addressed this in part in my paper last night on traditions of informational organization, because in fact that's a new tradition, but it has roots that go back in others. And what we need, it seems to me, I think you're right on the money on this, is to figure out how that adapts to our users. And maybe how to combine it with older views so that we have a multi-view type of retrieval system that allows whole object but also granular approaches to objects. But I'm most interested in, philosophically, in the ontology of this granular view. I don't think that's really been really studied yet. It is. Remember I said it toward the beginning, what happens when you can not only parse a text, but you can parse everything all the way down to the electronic signals that come in that are, in fact, the digital base? And how many levels of signal change between the base and the what you see on the screen? How does that ontologically fit in the idea of information use? I think that's part of this whole business. I don't know if library cataloging will be called library cataloging if we start doing that kind of thing, too. But I think that's what we ought to be doing. Yeah.
I've got something in my head. I would like to be able to figure out ways that I really meant to get there and back. And it seems that
You just said that again. Huh? When I was speaking of Robert Taylor and of Belkin and Adi, I was really talking about that. I was talking about this space that allows you to play around with the stuff, although I was saying in the form of query clarification, still we do use these systems to kind of clarify what we're doing, and yes, that's absolutely essential. And in the 20th century, or sorry about that, 21st century, we have to deal with that. And when are we going to start? And why do catalogers think that all they have to do is learn how to be in the one given system? I think that's dreadful. But that's, of course, my own prejudiced view. I've been a cataloger, by the way, for 42 years. I have seen all the technologies since the card catalog. I haven't gone behind that, although I have examined older ones. I have experienced them. I got into it just before they started creating the mark format. I've been there for all of it. I've seen it all in that sense. I've experienced. So it's not like I'm speaking out of turn or something. Yeah, Steve. Yeah. Well, there, Cutter and a whole bunch of libraries centered in Massachusetts and Connecticut tried a cooperative cataloging program where they would show what each one was buying and they would attach reviews to them and comments. I thought, that's brilliant. That's cool. But he said in his rules quite directly that we'll probably have to confine this to bibliographic details because some people might get offended by this or something. He didn't say that in those words, but the idea of expressing judgments is well, that's a social problem. You know? It's that little thing made big. Actually, the mark format has everything from the rules plus some data fields and data types that aren't in the rules. Like the rules say record the standard number, but they have fields for all kinds of different standard numbers that then get retrievable because in the rules they're not talked about as access points. They're just talked about as descriptive data. So there is additional stuff from the mark format. We actually, in the way they extend what we call keyword searching in an OPAC or in a webcat, they essentially get their keywords from the rest of the MARC record. They never go outside the MARC record. And so to put them into Google isn't going to do anything more. It won't get us any more results than we have from a keyword search in a normal catalog now, online catalog. The thing that Google has forced on us is to consider full-text indexing. Really, big time. I think Google sucks for certain kinds of searches. It's great for certain things. It's great for question answering type stuff. To get to a to kind of an answer you can fiddle around with. Sometimes it takes you longer than other times. What they doesn't do is give you any kind of relationships and prune the whole thing into a structure for you that is at least a starting place. One of the uses of classification, you know, we used to say one great classification and that's the way knowledge is organized. That's not real. But what is useful about a classificatory structure, no matter what it is it's a starting place. And you can disagree with it. But if you didn't have it as a starting place, you wouldn't even know how to begin. And if we, and there are all sorts of conflicts in this. By the way, OCLC, you know, has Dewey. It owns Dewey. Bought it for a buck in 1989. Now they transferred it. They have a conflict that I wonder if they recognize. And the conflict is, on the one hand, they want to make it into a system that you can buy and it works automatically, like you have your remote and you make your TV work. You don't want to know how the TV works. You just want it to work. Okay? Well, they've got WebDewey up, and it is like that. It's a number production system. But the way it really could be used powerfully is for people to understand the system, and you can't do that from WebDewey. What you have to do is get the print version and then study it without any study guides, because it's really complex and there's so much that could be said of it as a historical social document. You can see the history of psychology in it. It's fascinating. And I'm sorry, if you see all the additions. You have to see it as it changes over time. And you can see the history of psychology in the American scene, right, and buried in this classificatory structure. A story has never yet been told about why the engineering set is the way it is, because it, in fact, is an accretion. All the new engineers keep putting in little slots and holes in the thing, but it starts with the big two, civil engineering and military engineering. And then civil engineering breaks out into all these other areas one by one. Somebody in Wired magazine back in 1999 said something about Dewey Decimal classification is old-fashioned. I mean, what do you do with things like electrical engineering, electronic engineering? And I said, boy, this guy doesn't know anything. Electrical engineering was in the system in 1885. They knew about these things. But to see the growth of it, that's real education. That's thinking classified, and not just one system, but alternatives to it. I think that would be a brilliant place, an exciting place to study. Unless we got this idea that cataloging is a job that I want to go 8 to 5, and I don't want to think more than inputting into the given system. Sorry to be so hard. Yeah.
Yeah. But in listening to the description of the cricket of cataloging as it has been, I couldn't help but think about contrast that into the future of cataloging you envision, and how one of the differences is that there are lots of crossovers and parallels with objective and function for the education world in your new vision, unlike the cricket. And I wonder how you see that, those intersections impacting the future of cataloging.
Gee, I don't know if I can comment on the educational world. I'm going to have to put that one out to the audience. I'm not sure how to answer it. I think that ought to be out to the whole room. I profess ignorance at that point. And maybe I'm tired too. I don't know. What do you think? Should we call it quits for tonight? Got plenty to think about? Hope so. Okay.